Thank you for those pieces of introduction that prepare us for the rest of the service. I have lived a very sheltered life. A little bit over 50 years ago, I began attending Christopher Dock Mennonite High School in Pennsylvania as a sophomore. And ever since that time, I have been involved in Mennonite institutions as either a student, a teacher, an administrator, or a congregational lay leader. My only wandering outside of this Mennonite bubble was between high school and college when I worked at an apple orchard. And there was the occasional summer work experience during the years of college. I'm not sure that I'm proud of that fact, but it is my reality and I have to live with it. I suppose I have one more chance to expand my horizons during my retirement years. In addition to working in the Mennonite bubble, my growing up years were spent in a small Mennonite congregation consisting mostly of people related to each other in a very non-Mennonite area. I grew up knowing I was different from my school friends. Outside of school, I had very little contact with those friends that I had made in class. I didn't go to their campouts. I wasn't allowed to go to their birthday parties, especially those that included going to a movie theater. I had no concept that non-Mennonites might actually be Christians, especially those who advertised their bazaars in a local newspaper. And I was pretty sure that the only ones in heaven were going to be Mennonites. Mennonites were simply better people than everyone else. We didn't drink, we didn't smoke, we didn't get divorced. We certainly didn't have strawberry bazaars or lawn parties at our church. I am disappointed that those early years didn't provide me with the rich experience that was possible through learning to relate to a variety of people and a recognition that God is God of all people, not just we Mennonites. I am aware that some young people in similar Mennonite church situations become very outward focused and very integrated into their cultural context. While I don't blame my parents or the wonderful leaders of our congregation, again, mostly my relatives, I am disappointed that my worldview was so narrow during those formative years. At times, I am surprised that I stuck with the Mennonite church. But again, as Bob and Betty Lou just said, that's all I knew. It was the safest path forward. After living in Lancaster for many years, I gained a better understanding of how or why an Amish teenager could go back to using a buggy after using a car during their younger years or during the time of Rumspringa. What they grew up with is ingrained, it's known, and it's safe. When you know you are different than those around you, the easiest path is often to avoid interaction or relationship. So as I prepared my thoughts on God's empowerment of the Mennonite Church, I began with some personal reflection on why I stayed, why I have spent my entire professional career and my church engagement within the Mennonite faith. And I have to admit that the first answer is probably, that's all I've ever known. It's who I am. It's who I was. It's in my DNA. One of the challenging questions in this reflection process is whether the Anabaptist principles and practices that have been part of my entire life are based on heritage and tradition of that's what we've always done. It's from Uncle Harry and Aunt Edna. It's from Menno Simons. It's from George Blaurock. Or is it based on the teachings of Jesus? This question has haunted me for some time, and I would suggest that all of us who grew up in the Mennonite church should occasionally look in the mirror and ask that same question. Several years ago, there were a couple of coaches in our department who were devout Nazarenes. We had numerous conversations about faith expressions, and I often said to them that it seemed to me that we Mennonites often run right past the cross to get over here to peace, justice for all, and service. And you Nazarenes never get over here to peace and justice and service because you keep coming back to the cross Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. But we Mennonites forget that the reason we're doing it is because of the cross. I know it's a bit risky, but I did get some affirmation from a seminary professor before I used it publicly. So what are the Anabaptist distinctives that kept me engaged in the Mennonite church? And how have these distinctives been used to empower the church to live out our faith in Christ? This week, I asked several members of the congregation to respond to the following question. What are two Anabaptist or Mennonite beliefs or practices that distinguish them from other Protestant denominations? My apologies if you were not on my list. You may answer the question to yourself now if you'd like to. I imagine that you could list most of them. The responses included peace, non-resistance, service, separation of church and state, Sermon on the Mount living, community, and the priesthood of all believers. I would like to explore a few of these as they have played out in the Mennonite Church, empowering us to be God's people in the world. And since I believe a sermon should include a challenge, I will include some thoughts on how these distinctives may actually prevent us at times from fully engaging in discipleship, of fully engaging in following the way of Jesus, of truly being the hands and feet of Jesus to neighbors near and far. During World War I, many conscientious objectors were drafted and pressured into doing non-combatant service for the military. Others who refused were court-martialed and imprisoned. In 1940, as Congress considered draft legislation for World War II, Mennonites and others in the historic peace churches asked that Congress allow for an alternative service program more sensitive to the rights of the conscientious objectors. That program became Civilian Public Service, CPS, provided under the U.S. Selective Service and Training Act of 1940 for conscientious objectors who were unwilling to perform any kind of military service. By 1946, when the program ended, some 12,000 draft-age men served in CPS camps in various parts of the U.S., performing works of national importance in the areas of forestry, firefighting, agriculture, soil conservation, social services, and mental health services. I remember with fondness the times when the smoke jumpers would visit my home. They were friends of my dad. Does anybody remember the smoke jumpers? There were a few around. Those of you that don't know, look it up. It's fascinating stories. I also remember many of those who worked in the Norristown Mental Hospital, just outside of Philadelphia, who became very ingrained in the Fraser Mennonite Church. The first CPS camp opened in 1941, actually right here in the Shenandoah Valley in the town of Grottoes, to be exact. Those men in this camp worked with the Soil Conservation Service. By 1943, the CPS shifted a lot of its focus to the mental health institutions, and over 1,500 workers in 26 units across the country. The CPS program was followed by the PACS program, which started in 1951 and ended in 1976. The PACS program focused on the rebuilding the war-torn areas of Europe. So while the CPS focused on the United States, this was a totally new outreach to go into the war-torn areas of Germany and beyond. It was so successful that other countries requested the help of the PACS program, and it was expanded into the areas of Paraguay, Palestine, Greece, and Bolivia. I remember vividly traveling to New York with family and friends to see one of our young men board the ship and head off to Germany for the PACS program. The description of the PACS program perhaps is best stated from this reflection, which you can find on the MCC website. Even though the PACS program originated as an American Mennonite project, the mutual benefit of the PACS boys for the European Mennonites and the refugees soon became very obvious. It seemed that every person, every pastor, every congregation, every conference, every organization, and every national Mennonite group knew and supported the program with finances, material, and volunteer service. In retrospect, this amazing cooperation may be without equal in Mennonite history. Both groups were givers and receivers by sharing experiences, working together, worshiping together, and many bonding for life. There are still American tour groups visiting the families in refugee settlements, while some of the ex-refugees are still visiting PACS boys in America. The mutual benefit from the Global PACS program, helping and being helped, was and is attested to by almost every PACS worker with the quote, "It opened my life to the world." The refugee recipients of PACS service around the world will never forget their friendship and help receive the help they receive from the PACS boys. In my mind, these two programs empowered Mennonite men to not only live out their objection to violence and war, but to also be the hands and feet of Jesus to others in the world. It provided a public forum in which the Mennonite church was able to share their vision of what it means to be a follower of Christ, sharing the Jesus way. These programs were also the precursor for the Mennonite Voluntary Service Program. With MVS units in a variety of places across the country, both conscientious objectors who were called up in the draft, as well as others who wanted to take time between high school and college or between college and career, had the opportunity to be of service to others and expand their horizons. Perhaps Mennonite Disaster Service comes the closest to the excitement and the ongoing ministry, closest to the CPS and PACS programs of the past, meeting the others by sharing your time, talents, and being the hands and feet of Jesus. I lived through the last years of the draft in the early 70s. By the time I was 18, there was a draft lottery, and I remember receiving my lottery number in the mail. I think it was number 83 or 86, I forget, which was right on the border of what most thought would be the cutoff for being drafted. I was not drafted, but I was making alternative plans in place of going to college. I will confess that avoiding the draft was the motivating factor in preparing for alternative service, not necessarily a strong desire to be the hands and feet of Jesus in some other place. Was I entering alternative service because of Jesus' teaching, or just because that's what the young men did in my congregation? Was the conscientious objector position a convenience for the time of the draft, or has it been forgotten? I suspect that that was the position of many of the young men at that time, although I don't want to be judgmental to them. But I know there were quick weddings, because if you were married, you were exempt. There were other statuses that you could get to that would allow you to be exempt from the draft. There was a lot of education during the 70s about the conscientious objector position. Sessions were held to prepare young men to face the draft board and how to explain their convictions against serving in the military. There was mental and emotional preparation for the possibility of spending time in jail. While conference mission agencies as well as Mennonite Mission Network continue to sponsor programs that provide opportunities to serve others and reflect Christ, there is clearly not the fervor for the kinds of service programs that existed during the 30 years from the 40s to the 70s. So what has changed? Clearly, there is no longer a draft. I hear very little within our congregations about the conscientious objector position. Mennonite voluntary service units are closing. Was the peace and non-resistance position helpful for me during the draft, but maybe not so important today? Perhaps there is, or I'd like to suppose that there could be, a shift in our meaning and application of peace from being anti-military to peace as a path for justice to all. And non-resistance may want to be reshaped into nonviolence. It's a subtle but important shift. I also wonder at times, since Mennonites do not typically mix evangelism with service, I wonder, did the refugees, did the people in the mental institutions, did they ever know that the reason we were doing it was because of Jesus? Or was it just because we were good people? And that's what Mennonites do. A second Anabaptist belief or practice that was named is community. And I'll add to it the concept of the priesthood of all believers as I see them being very integrated, with one impacting the other a lot. I often tell freshman students at EMU that they will likely hear the word community over a million times by the time they graduate. Again, it is one that is in our DNA. We develop communities in our congregations as well as in the many Mennonite church agencies. Community provides us the incentive to care for each other at the deepest of levels and in all circumstances. We care deeply about each other, even more than ourselves at times. We give selflessly. I believe that the concept of the priesthood of all believers enhances community as it empowers everyone to be part of the church and the mission of the church. In the Mennonite church, it's not about the leaders. It's about the congregation. It's about the community. Everyone has a voice in discerning Scripture, in establishing a mission and vision, in determining the use of our resources, and in the selection of leaders. Community is how we function best. We strive to be described as the early church was in Acts 4, with all believers being of one heart and mind, God's grace so powerfully at work in them that there were no needy persons among them. Building community is one way that God has empowered Mennonites and the Mennonite church to live out our individual and our corporate faith, to be the hands and feet of Jesus to each other and to the world, neighbors near and far. However, while building communities has helped us to serve each other, have we allowed these communities to become exclusive? Is everyone truly welcome in our community? We might say so, but do the practices of our community express otherwise? And might they at times express exclusivity? One of the greatest challenges that I have in my work at EMU is to somehow make EMU a place that all people own, that all people feel like family. We can say we are open to other people, but as soon as we begin playing the Mennonite game, we have excluded many, many people. I don't know how to get around that because it's just who I am. And when someone says they're recruiting an athlete here, oh yeah, I know them. I know their parents, their uncles. I went to school with them. We go back and forth. The challenge that I have is the fact that if we are truly to be open, then every student who comes in there should feel it as their place. They should be able to take ownership of that place. And I think too often it doesn't work out that way. The challenge is to truly make it the little things we do as Mennonites, the use of MCC, the use of all of our acronyms, right away put someone else on the outside. Danger comes in the sense of how we live out community, in my view. Will they always be a guest? And I'm not just talking about racial, ethnic, whatever. I'm talking about everyone. Because if they don't own the place, they don't ever give back to that place. And so I think we would have to say the same about our congregations. Are we truly open to everybody? What does it mean to be community? As it relates to the communities of faith and our desire to be united, I also have to ask the question, if community is so important and valuable to us, why did three more congregations leave Virginia Mennonite Conference yesterday during the delegate assembly? 316 Community Church, which is formerly Hickory Mennonite Church in North Carolina, Gospel Hill Mennonite Church in Falks Run, and The Table in Harrisonburg. Perhaps practicing the priesthood of all believers, discerning together, being community, somehow creates more gray areas than some people might be comfortable with. I should also mention that during that same delegate assembly, the congregation Mosaic of Grace, pastored by Mike and Risha Metzler, was added to the Virginia Conference. In a similar vein, Mennonites have often expressed practiced the concept that there's always room at the table for more. You may be familiar with a cookbook published by Menno Media entitled Extending the Table. This was clearly evidenced in my home as we had a Sunday routine of mom leaving church as soon as it was over so she could start preparing food for whomever dad invited for Sunday lunch. Deb and I tend to have some of those traits, opening our home to and food to others. But I often ask myself, is our table really open to everyone or just those we know? And yes, our table is open, but it's in our house. It's on our terms. So am I really open and invitational to all people, regardless of race, creed, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation and preference, Republican, Democrat, Christian, Muslim, conservative, liberal, Lowe's, Home Depot, etc., etc.? A major portion of our delegate assembly yesterday was given to a report from the Racial Justice Task Force and smaller group discussions. We can no longer ignore the issues of racism and injustice in our community. There will be training of conference leaders first, then congregational leaders, and then congregations. We here at Zion will be dealing with these issues in the near future. And I wonder, will our Anabaptist desire to be the quiet in the land, this gathered community here in the pristine Shenandoah Valley, just south of Broadway, will that prevent us from dealing effectively with the issues of today? I am indebted to my parents, relatives, and mentors at Fraser Mennonite Church, who demonstrated to me the values and the practices of the Anabaptist. They showed me what it means to follow in Jesus' way, to live out the Sermon on the Mount, to be the hands and feet of Jesus to others. I pray that I, along with each of you as my community, will seek to explore how these Anabaptist beliefs and practices are best expressed in our world today.